Just sitting here with the legend herself, Miss Dori Ladner. At the on June 16th, the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the call for Black Power. We just ran 40th. Soweto, the 40th of Soweto, the Tupac's birthday. Baba Ize helping out with the quick. We just all at this event. So this is an impromptu gathering. Two young brothers. What are your names?
Joshua.
Joshua. Chinua. And Chinua. And you just started telling us about your experience with, you were talking about reading C.L.R. James and his book about, his writings about Walter Rodney, and then telling us about Walt Rodney, whose anniversary of his assassination just passed, being at your house. I had to grab the mic real quick. So if you would just start with that story, is this the time you're working with SNCC already, or is this what's going on? And set the context.
1970. Okay. 1970. And I had left SNCC in around 67. But I met Brother Walter Rodney. As I was saying, I was reflecting on him because I was reading C.L.R. James' critique of Walter's assassination, and he had some strong words. He said that Walter had not built up a base strong enough to support him. You had Jagan and Burnham right there, and he didn't have enough organization to protect him. That's my interpretation. People who read it may differ. But in this book that I have, there were several people who were speaking about his work and his life story. And Bobby Hill also talked. Bobby Hill is from Jamaica. I got to know him there. At the Institute of the Black World, Dr. Vincent Harding, is the one who developed this program. And I was talking about Brother Rodney coming to the Institute of Black World and staying at our house in Atlanta, and he developed this very strong fever, and so much so until my sister and I had to take him to Grady Hospital, which was a very segregated. He was in the Spalding unit, which was the wing for Black people at the time, and his fever became so elevated until they packed him in ice and he started losing consciousness, and all the people who were attending him were very frightened, including the medical doctors. And I kept saying, you have the CDC, the Center for Disease Control here in Atlanta. Why can't you get a diagnosis? And they were acting like they really didn't want to be bothered with him. They were gowned and he had plastic forks and so forth. And in the meantime, his fever was continuing to elevate. Well, we had notified his wife, Pat, in Tanzania, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. And she flew from Tanzania to Atlanta, Georgia. The plane landed. We met her at the airport and described his symptoms. She said, oh, he forgot to take his malaria tablets. He has malaria. And you can imagine the relief that I felt knowing that I wasn't going to die, because I thought I was going to die. Whatever he had, I was going to die too. But I would like to describe to the people that Walter Rodney was a very intense and sincere young man who was who had a vision, who wanted to, his writings on how Europe underdeveloped Africa, and he was had some more that I can't think of right now, but he was had left Ghana and gone to Tanzania and then came back and went again. My sister Joyce went to Tanzania from the Institute of Black World to finish her book that she published, which was part of her dissertation. And as a result, that's how he ended up staying with us. But I was so taken with him and his wife, Pat, and they had two children. So the other thing I want to talk about is that African Liberation Day here in Washington, the first African Liberation Day, which is at Malcolm X Park. There were many, many different nations, first Americans, you had the Eritrean movement, you had the Latin American movement. At that time, Leonard Peltier was not incarcerated, I don't think. You just had all kinds of nations, and my husband and I drove from Atlanta, Georgia to Washington, D.C. to be part of this event. And we got here, and I was overwhelmed in the park looking at all the people. You know, having worked in SNCC, we did not have that kind of those kinds of allies at the time we were on the ground when we started organizing Mississippi, knocking on doors and getting people ready to vote. But I was overwhelmed at the coalitions that had developed as a result of work that not only Muhammad Ali, who sprang forth and developed a platform for us to have space with his articulation about, hell no, I'm not going to war, and that gave us a platform and other people platforms to articulate their dissent. And there were many dissents being brought about. And somebody mentioned RAND, Revolutionary Action Movement, Max Stanford and John Churchville there in Philadelphia. You had many, many different coalitions working. I remember the first time I met Ron Karinga was in the Martin Luther King Library in the basement at Inter Theological Center there in Atlanta, Georgia, working on trying to develop the Martin Luther King Center. And all I can say is that this is 2016, and having worked all of my life, and I still have this desire and this interest and this energy to continue working, is that when I have these moments that, as Brother Ball said, to talk, he said, I want to talk to you right now. And Brother Aziz said, I want to talk to you right now. So we don't usually have the platform to articulate. We may have them in our head, or may want to make a note or something, but I want to thank you for this platform for me to be able to articulate this time in history. And thank you very much.
No, thank you. Thank you.
I just have a question, Ms. Leiter. So, you know, here we are talking about Black Power, and you are talking about, you know, Walter Rodney. You know, he also wrote Groundings with My Brother, and, you know, he was about Black Power in Guyana. Right. And so what was the conversation like with you and Walter Rodney? You talking about Black Power here in the U.S., and he's looking internationally at Black Power. What was that conversation like?
Well, C.L.R. James indicated that, you know, you had the Pan-African movement for Walter to tap into, like the Black GIs who came back during World War II. And they were disenchanted with the state of affairs when they returned from fighting. And Walter did have an active group, Padmore, and all the others I can't think of. But he was a very gifted intellectual, and he was able to come out of Guyana. But talking about Black Power, Walter worked for Black people to be able to have a space and an economy to support them. And where he grew up in Guyana, you know, it was a colonial power and or neo-colonial or whatever, and they did not have the means that they wanted, and they were very dependent on that economy. And talking to him and the book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, I mean, you're talking about a visionary ahead of his time, ahead of his time. And he was punished for that. He was punished for that. They don't like that. I mean, you know, you can talk surface things, but there are a lot of us in SNCC who started reading Camus and what's the brother's name in Nigeria? Not Nigeria, Algeria.
Fanon.
I remember Charlie Cobb walking around in Jackson, Mississippi with it in the back of his pocket. I mean, we started in 63, reading. But always a search for knowledge, not only on the ground, but what other people, intellectuals around the world were thinking and how we could incorporate that and use that to our own advantage. And fortunately, we were able to meet some of the people because when Brother Kwame Stokely was married Makeba in 67, I was invited, 1967, I was at their wedding, and of course, I have a photo of it. And he said, you must come. And I got there, and all these people were there, African nations, you know, all these African people were sitting there in their garb, and I'm looking around. But, you know, coming out of Mississippi, all this is unfolding, and I'm talking, I'm a native of Mississippi, and always trying to see what's beyond the next phase. So, but all to incorporate, if I may digress, Harry Belafonte took a group of SNCC people, which included Robert Moses, Bob Moses, who worked in Mississippi and was still working, and Miss Fannie Lou Hamer, John Lewis, I'm not sure about the others, and Donna Richards, who's now, I can't call, she was married to Bob, took them to Guinea, and they may have gone into Ghana, I'm not sure. But the experience that SNCC had with linking up with other nations. And I look at young people now, you know, they are covering the same ground that we covered. And I want to know, when is it going to end? When are we going to stop having to redo this all over again? Didn't I just do this last year? Didn't I just do this 30 years ago? Didn't I do this? When is it going to stop? When Eric Garner was choked to death and murdered, and little Trayvon Martin, you know, that took me back to Emmett Till, which started me on this journey. The young black man who was murdered by two brothers and thrown in the Tallahatchie River in Mississippi.
Two white men who were brothers. Just want to make sure that people listening aren't confused, thinking you're talking about brothers. This is white men who were brothers killed this young brother. Right, just want to be clear.
Two white men.
Yeah, just want to be clear.
Murdered this 15-year-old young black man who whistled at Bryant's wife. And I was 14 years old at the time. And that is what pricked my consciousness. And I said, if they did, although I felt his pain that far away, it was like over 200 miles on the Memphis border. I'm down near New Orleans where I grew up. And I said, if they did it to him, they'll do it to me. And when I saw that photograph of his face, that photograph is what just took a lot of us in SNCC on that journey. And Chuck McDew, John Robert Lewis, Diane Nash, James Bevel, Marion Barry, all of us. When I met Stokely and Cortland, they were being mentored by Byatt Rustin as high school students. So you had all these linkages. I'm rambling back and forth, but I had Clyde Kennard, who was sent to Parchman Penitentiary for attempting to enroll in the University of Southern Mississippi. And he had attended the University of Chicago and wanted to complete his education. But he was accused of stealing chicken feed for his farm, which he didn't. And he languished in the Parchman Penitentiary for several years. And then Attorney General Robert Kennedy ordered that he be released, ordered Governor Roy Barnett to release him before he expired. And I had dropped out of college. I dropped out of college three times. I went to, you're trying to get my freedom. It was my freedom. Mm-hmm. Freedom from oppression, freedom from resistance. I came from a very strong family. My mother's family was very strong, and my mother told us not to let anybody abuse us, and I took that. But going to see Mr. Kennard, who was dying from pancreatic cancer, after he had attempted to enroll in the University of Southern Mississippi, and he expired on July 4th, 1963. But he told me to continue my work to get an education. He bore no malice towards anyone. And then my other mentor was Mr. Vernon Damer, who was murdered trying to come out of his house. He was a very strong advocate for justice, NAACP president there in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. He was in the Keller Settlement area. And him and his sister used to take my sister and I to NAACP state meetings in Jackson, Mississippi, and told us not to let anybody abuse us and so forth. So, but as I was talking about Stokely and Cortland being mentored by Byatt, now I was being mentored by them, and then other people had exposure to others. So the seeds were being planted in our heads. And so when SNCC met in Raleigh in 1960, I wasn't there, but Miss Baker sent out a call to all historically black colleges for college students to come to Shaw University. And like we're discussing here right now tonight at the Civil War Memorial and Museum, discussing ideas. And the reason it was called a coordinating committee was because it wasn't supposed to be an organization, but to coordinate with the students across the South. And Marion Barry was his first president, and on and on and on. You may want to ask me some questions because I'm really talking more than I had planned.
Well, one question I do want to ask, if we can, for me, one of the problems that I have looking back at that time period is the way it's remembered, both in popular culture and media, but also in academia and ultimately in the minds of young people. When you hear the phrase black power, how do you define black power? What does black power actually mean for you?
Black power, I had been exposed to it all my life, but it had not come into a cohesive unit, meaning that I grew up in a black community. I was mentored by black people. I was born from a black woman, a black father. And we were striving to come into our own, so to speak. I attended black churches, sang black hymns and so forth. But when Stokely articulated black power, him and Ricks there in Greenwood, it meant that the work that we had been doing with SNCC had been defined. I'll use that word, been defined. It had been defined. And what we had been doing all those years was trying to come into black power and to put a stamp on it and say, this is what who we are and this is what we've been doing. And I talked about Muhammad Ali when he uttered, I'm not going to the war. And SNCC in 1966, January of 1966, had put out a statement saying that we weren't supporting the war. And when Muhammad Ali articulated that, hell no, I'm not going to the war. I'm not going to kill anyone. I'm thinking about Donald Stone, who went to prison, and Cleve Sellers, who was on his way to prison, and so forth, and many others, because they were opposed to the war. You know, they had the draft, in effect. And all of this came into being, but when black power was uttered, it shook not only this country, but around the world, because you had all the third world people who were under colonialism, neo-colonialism, and being used like we were here. You're talking about Soweto and Mandela and all them. They were Sharpeville. We knew about that. We weren't getting much news. The reason I live here in the nation's capital is because I have access to information. And where I grew up in Mississippi, I didn't have that information. So we got bits and pieces. But black power was a definition that defined the work that black people had been doing, and it was defined, and we knew what we had been doing. And see, in Alabama, when the Black Panther symbol was put up, it scared so many people. Like, oh my God. I remember being in New York, and one of our best friends, well, she was just mystified, a white woman. She was just horror. Can you imagine New York? Can you imagine a Black Panther? A Black Panther. Oh my God. Oh my God. And so it was scaring people. It was literally scaring people. I mean, you said black power, and then you come up with a panther, which was really, really horrific and a creature within his own right that would destroy anything. I mean, a fierce creature. So all these definitions were being put out and defining, knocking on doors, hard organizing is hard work. And so when you have black power and you put a Black Panther there, and see, this Black Panther had been, a symbol had been put out before the black power was uttered. And when we got to marching, Dr. King and Abernathy and all the others, McKissick was more in line with us than the others, you know. Dr. King had sort of been beat down to a large degree, because his nonviolence was there, but he had become disenchanted with progress that was being made. And his Riverside speech said that, and late Vincent Harding wrote that speech, and when he said that he was opposed to the war, that was the kiss of death for him. But I'm rambling all over, but these are just things that we were involved with. And
I mean, let me just ask specifically, and because, you know, at one point, Nixon sort of started a move to define black power, and he specifically said, I don't want black people defining it as Stokely was defining it. I want it defined as black capitalism and black elected officials. Mm-hmm. And for many, I think today, that is how black power is defined. A lot of young people, I think, a lot of people in my generation consider black power to mean the individual or small group material success. But as Stokely or Kwame was articulating it, it was about scientific socialism and Pan-Africanism and anti-imperialism. where, I mean, how did you then deal with that debate, and how do you now deal with the debate over definition?
Under Richard Nixon, he started putting a lot of money out into the black community, black capitalism, and many people benefited through different programs that he had started, that he started with monies. And he started defining black capitalism, and black people were part of that. But, and this was the end of the 60s, going in the 70s, and people sort of moving around and trying to redefine a lot of things. And you had the poverty programs coming up in New York. Imamu Baraka was there in New York. And in Atlanta, Georgia, where I had moved to, you had a poverty program in St. Louis, Missouri. It was called Human Development Corporation. But these were entities that employed a lot of black people. And because the last brother who spoke today was talking about controlling your own industry and so forth, and you had no jobs. Because one thing I must say, that after the rebellion, when Dr. King was murdered, it was very clear that you had excess manpower in this country. And that was black people, black women, black men, right here in the nation's capital. And I was in Atlanta, Georgia, watching the national news when they said that Washington, D.C. had been stricken with a drug problem. And people who used to be very industrious about going to work and very fierce about demanding work, they were now sedated. They were sleeping. And I'm thinking about what Ho Chi Minh said about the French sedating them. Mm-hmm. And they had to fight that war, and they in turn sedated our young people who came back sedated. And so that was a big problem once they were reintroduced back to this country. And you start having a methadone program and all that to try to quell that. But at this point in time, we have an excess amount of manpower and no production.
Ms. Ladder, I just want to thank you again for doing this. I appreciate you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. Thank you, Brother Ball. And thank you, my brother.
Oh, no.